Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So it comes down to two very simple and straightforward propositions. Austerity in times of recession is bad economics, it's counterproductive for economies and for nations as a whole, and the kind of austerity that they're trying to impose in Europe, in Canada, in the United States, is essentially a form of incredibly aggressive class warfare on the part of the 1% who have essentially reaped all of the benefits of productivity growth in the world economy over the past 30 years.
That's the voice of author and economist Robin Hennell. On this week's show, we speak to Robin about the connections between austerity and inequality and a roadmap to change. Stay tuned.
We're very privileged to have Dr. Robin Hennell. He is an economist. His latest book, Participatory Economics. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you this morning.
Can we talk a little bit about the relationship between austerity, this constant process of cutting, and the level of inequality that it creates?
It's actually very simple and straightforward. When a capitalist economy is in recession, that's your own country, and then we can apply it to the global economy as well, you know, in the current situation. So when both globally and in all the advanced economies, we have recession that we've been living with since 2008 that really has not gone away. The last quarter in the United States, we had negative growth again. So pretty soon they won't even be able to say, technically, we are no longer in a recession. When that's the situation, then austerity is bad economics. Forget political issues. Forget class issues. Forget whether it's a left economist or right economist or who's talking. It's just plain bad economics. Because what austerity at the government level means is cutting back on spending and or increasing taxes. Both of those things will further aggravate the recessionary slide. They will increase unemployment rates. They will not decrease unemployment rates. Economists have known this since the time of Keynes, since the time of the Great Depression. We now have a massive denial of this piece of economic wisdom. Now, what does this have to do with inequality? Well, when you look at the composition of how it is that the right-wing forces want to impose the austerity, that's where the inequality comes in. In the United States right now, what the Republican parties are saying, we are now going to once again, you know, on March 1st, we are again back in this dilemma where we have negotiated some sort of crazy outcome where we're going to have across-the-board cuts, you know, in all programs in the United States. Well, that's going to have a further depressionary effect on the economy. That's going to guarantee that next quarter will also be negative growth, just as the last one was. But what the Republicans are holding out for is they want austerity that takes the following form. They don't want to cut the military budget in the United States. They want to cut all of the domestic programs. This is money going to education, money going to health care, money going to sort of actual programs that are on life support already for ordinary people. That's who they want to impose the austerity on, and they want to preserve and protect the tax cuts for the super wealthy that were put into effect in the U.S. over the past 15 years. That's where the sort of class warfare, you know, aspect of the austerity campaign comes in. So it comes down to two very simple and straightforward propositions. Austerity in times of recession is bad economics. It's counterproductive for economies and for nations as a whole. And the the kind of austerity that they're trying to impose in Europe, in Canada, in the United States, is essentially a form of incredibly aggressive class warfare on the part of the 1% who have essentially reaped all of the benefits of productivity growth in the world economy over the past 30 years.
You have written a brilliant book called Of the People, By the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. And I want us to realize that this class war takes two fronts. We are also fighting back. So can we talk a little bit about what a participatory economy means for issues of equality, issues of solidarity, and the political issues that seem to constantly fragment us?
There's two important sort of purposes that talking about and, you know, talking with people about, a very different kind of economy, a participatory economy, has. The first one is very, very practical and very, very pragmatic. During the middle third of the 20th century, really for the first time, was the only time when capitalist economies in Europe, Canada, and the United States were reformed to a certain extent to allow the growth of a middle class. Now, looking back on it historically, those of us who grew up in that period had a vision that, well, this is the way things will slowly improve. This is the course of history. Well, what we have seen over the past 30 years is, well, that might have been a very exceptional period. That this kind of economy that I just call the economics of competition and greed, that, yes, it was reformed through Herculean organizing and political efforts and sacrifices on the part of, you know, social movements, labor movements, consumer movements, all sorts of powerful political forces, essentially managed to win a degree of reform, you know, in some capitalist economies. Well, for the past 30 years, what we've discovered is that if you leave the market system and if you leave the major private ownership in the hands of giant corporations, if you leave that system in place, then all the gains that you make are always subject to rollback. You have to keep fighting and you have to keep swimming upstream. So one purpose in talking about, well, why should we put up with an economy that constantly puts us in a position of barely winning things that are not good enough, and then always having that subject to the kind of exactly what you started asking about, which is, well, what is this austerity about? Well, it's a form of class warfare where the top people are, again, trying to take back even more than they already have. Why are they in a position to do that? Because we left the economy running in a way that gives them all the money, them all the power, them all the political, you know, advantages, then the ownership of the media so that they can essentially set the terms of the debate, have the country and people thinking and discussing things that have nothing to do with solving real problems. So that's the first purpose. Why should we, having watched this go on, why should we continue to put up with a system that puts all people fighting for decent things, saving the environment, you know, middle class opportunities for everybody? Why should we put ourselves in a situation where we're constantly fighting, you know, at a terrible disadvantage? And then the other purpose of writing about this and talking about it in a book like Of the People, For the People, is to essentially challenge the myth that the only choice is between the economics of competition and greed, some form of capitalism where maybe you fight, you fight, you fight, you win a little, and you hope you don't get rolled back, and succumbing to some sort of totalitarian planning a la the old Soviet socialist economies of the 20th century. Because that's the other great myth, that the people who are who are reaping the advantages of the present system, that's the other myth that they would like to perpetrate, that there is no choice between capitalism and command planning. And that was the other reason that we basically devised the model to show that, no, that's not true. Workers and consumers can run their own economy, and really until we do, the economy is not going to work for the people. Unless the economy is of the people and by the people, then in the long run, it's foolish to expect that it's going to be run for the people. Unless people are running their own economy, whoever is running the economy, whatever elite is running the economy supposedly for them, will not in the long run be doing it for the people. They will be doing it to serve the interests of the elite. And basically what we now have is a form of capitalism where the top 1%, the system is running to the benefit of the top 1%. And that is ever more clear. That's why they have no interest in good economic policy that will pull us out of the recession, because they're not in a recession. The stock market's not in a recession. And they certainly want to insist that essentially it's everybody else has to give up their middle-class aspirations, you know, their decent school systems, their decent health care. That's what has to go. They're not losing their elite education systems. They're not losing their health care. They're saying the system can no longer afford those things. That is patently absurd. Economies are 3 or 4 times more productive than they were when decent health care systems and Social Security were put into effect. We can afford more of that for more people. The idea that we can no longer afford these things is an absolute lie.
So can we talk a little bit about the role that education needs to undertake then to even embrace the idea of a participatory economy?
Well, certainly. I mean, we can start right with the economics profession. And the economics profession is completely complicit with a campaign in our economic programs, in what is taught as economics, you know, from Econ 101 for freshmen right up through PhD programs. Economics is taught in a way that says there are only two alternatives. The command planning has obviously failed, and therefore, you know, the economics of competition and greed is the only way to go. The economics profession has gone much further than that. It's actually, you know, aided and abetted the myth that if you simply allow all decisions to be made through free markets, not that we actually have free markets, the markets are mostly manipulated by giant corporations. And the idea that corporations are not, you know, major recipients of government welfare in terms of corporate welfare, that whole myth is something else that's mythical. But the idea that, oh, if we simply allow all economic decisions to be made in the free marketplace, including free market finance, including free market health care, the economics profession as a profession has been essentially selling that message. Any voices speaking up within the profession to say, but the evidence suggests that this doesn't always work out very well, those voices have been increasingly silenced within the profession by associations like the American Economic Association, by the major journals that simply will not consider articles and publications by heterodox economists. I mean, an excellent example of this is that some of the luminaries, the brightest names in economics, you know, Nobel Prize winners, people like Amartya Sen, people like Paul Krugman, people like Joseph Stiglitz, these were recognized by the profession when they were young economists as being amongst the brightest and the best within the profession. All three of those people who I just mentioned have essentially been drummed out of the profession. The mainstream of the economics profession considers them now to be heretics and essentially just refuses to listen to them. Well, how did that happen? They were brilliant guys, and they had eyes in their head, and they could see that the kind of globalization that was sort of permitting capital liberalization and destroying one East Asian or South American or African economy after another in the 90s, they could see that that wasn't working. And when they spoke up and said that, and when Paul Krugman speaks up and says this austerity is nonsense, this has absolutely nothing to do with good economics, well, then the profession just sort of considers them persona non grata. So, yes, the economics profession bears a major responsibility for a tremendous amount of miseducation of the public at large and students going through economics curriculum about how the economy works, what works well, what doesn't work, and what we can do and what we can't do. And they certainly perpetuate the myth that we have no choice between communism and free market capitalism. certainly do everything they can to make people believe that those are the choices that they have.
I wanted to, perhaps because you cover this in your book, talk a little bit about what happens when we create horizontal organizations that are non-hierarchical, that cooperate and propel a different version of social relations, one that is collaborative and reciprocal.
What you just mentioned is that there are lots of places in the world right now where more and more people and organizations are going about making decisions in a very different way, basically in a way that's democratic, and in which the people who are affected by things, the people who are doing the work, the consumers who are eating the food, they are getting more involved in deciding how it is that this is all going to be managed. There's two results of this. One is that there's increasing evidence that it works. It's not perfect. It's sort of sloppy. Mistakes do get made. It can be frustratingly slow. But then what are we to compare it to? If you look at the disaster that the ruling elites are creating, the economic policy disaster, the climate policy disasters, the environmental policy disasters, well, you don't have to be perfect to do far better than that. And that's part of what we're realizing, that as much as the elites never tire of pointing out where democratic decision-making sometimes is slow and frustrating and doesn't always come to the right conclusion, well, they would have you compare that to the presumption that when you leave it to quote-unquote elites, that they always make brilliant decisions that are absolutely perfect. And, of course, that's not what's going on. As people engage in more and more democratic decision-making about economic things, we improve. We essentially discover how it is that we need to better coordinate. And that's another thing that, you know, I've tried to contribute to in a book like Of the People, By the People. We really do have to sit down and think about what are the most effective ways to make economic democratic decision-making efficient. What are the best ways to organize it so it doesn't take up too much time? What are the best ways of organizing it so that people actually get the critical information they need in order to make informed judgments and decisions? Those are all things which we need to work out as we're doing it, and we need to think through. But that's the course we should be on. And if the economics profession was really helping humankind, what the economics profession would be devoting most of its time to is figuring out, thinking, and publishing ideas about how to make participatory economic democratic decision-making more effective and better.
Well, one of the things that we can look back when we get all awestruck and wonder whether we could do better is to look at the brilliant decisions that have been made by elites and the so-called knowing professionals, right? The NAFTA implementation that led to lowering and eliminating of tariffs in some places, in Mexico in particular, and throughout Latin America, and the relationship that this has created, the dumping of subsidized corn and all kinds of, decimation of our agricultural-based societies in Latin America, but
the neoliberal globalization has been a bona fide disaster for a majority of people on the planet. The elites that have made the decision to dig the tar sands out of Alberta and basically burn them, the dirtiest stuff you can burn, and you burn all that, and you basically condemn the planet to an unacceptable risk of really cataclysmic climate change. Those are the kinds of the decisions that the elites are making. The elites are making the decision that we're going to frack. You know, in the eastern part of the United States, we're going to engage in a technology that is very, very dangerous to do what? To increase our ability to burn fossil fuels when exactly what we have to be doing is decreasing our burning of fossil fuels. You have elites that are deciding in Europe that the solution to their economic problem is to just foist more austerity on Spain and Greece and Italy, despite all the evidence that is completely counterproductive. Those are the brilliant decisions that the elites are making. You can go back to Wall Street. Oh, the Wizards of Wall Street. What the financial industry is supposed to do in a capitalist economy is basically channel the savings of hundreds of millions of people into socially productive investment. Well, Wall Street, where did they channel the world's savings during the 80s and the 90s? Into one asset bubble after another, a stock market bubble, a dot-com bubble, a mammoth real estate bubble, the worst kind that the world economy had ever seen. These asset bubbles produce no wealth. They produce no increase in productivity. They are very, very dangerous. They are very, very counterproductive. Wait a minute. Where did we need the savings to be channeled? We need the savings to be channeled into investment in renewable energy sources, into, you know, programs to increase energy efficiency and conservation. Did the Wizards of Wall Street, did the elites of the financial world, you know, channel the savings of the world into the socially productive investments that were needed? No, they did just the opposite. So we have increasing evidence that the elite decision makers who are running the world, you know, are just making one terrible decision after another. Now, it's terrible from the perspective of the environment. It's terrible from the perspective of the well-being of ordinary people. It's not terribly from the perspective of whether the elites are doing better. So they're serving their interests quite brilliantly, but they are increasingly doing it at the expense of the rest of us in what's an increasingly obvious way, which is why more and more people hopefully are getting upset.
We're coming to the end of our interview, but I wondered if you could comment on the possibilities we create when we organize across borders, when we envision this participatory movement, not only within our small communities, logically we have to act locally, but when we envision this as a growing movement that can, you know, can include us all on a global scale.
We inevitably have to act locally to build movements that are dedicated to protecting the environment, distributing burdens and benefits of, you know, equitably and fairly. You fight locally, but you only win in a context where there is winning going on by other organizations and other campaigns and other places. The tar sand things is an excellent example. Canadians have to do everything within their power to prevent that disaster. That's the fossil fuel industry, that's the Harper government, that's their vision of what it is they want to do with Canada. It's a disaster. There are wonderful environmentalists fighting against that, fighting against building the pipelines across the, it's not just the pipeline, the one that's coming down the Keystone, you know, in the United States. They're going ahead and putting pipelines over to the Pacific up there in the north of B.C., those are campaigns that have to be fought in Canada. Well, there's no reason that environmental organizations in the United States can't help those campaigns, can't help raise money for those campaigns, and they are. And at the same time, we can go and we can demonstrate at the White House, and we can say this is just an absolute disaster. We have the president in a situation where he can't essentially, you know, duck the responsibility for something. Everybody knows that he gets to make the decision on the pipeline. So he can't sort of blame Congress and say, I had no choice. He has it within his power to simply say no. And we have to fight and make sure that he understands that the consequences of not making the right decision in that area, you know, are going to be severe in terms of what kind of opposition that he's going to get from U.S. environmentalists. So there's an excellent example of a campaign that has to be fought locally where you are, but we are going to win or lose together.
That's a beautiful example. I was thinking that, you know, not only are we interconnected on the struggle for ecological justice, which means having an earth to live upon for our next generations, but also in terms of our political struggles for redefining our imagination, you know, imagining something greater. And our struggles are interconnected with those people in Latin America, you know, in Venezuela, in Bolivia. With the idea that we can create a society that is run from the bottom up, that we can move, you know, a different kind of government. I wonder if you could just in closing tell us what inspires you. What do you see in these sparks that we see throughout Latin America and through that offer us a different way of imagining our relations with the state, with each other?
I suspect it's always been this way, but progressive movements, you know, develop and become stronger at different times in different places. And one of the places in the world that progressive movements for a different way of running economies, movements that said, no, we don't want 20th century, Soviet socialism, but we are completely unconvinced, that the kind of capitalism that neoliberal globalization visited on Latin America, sort of first and foremost in the 80s and the 90s, they went through the experience of that disaster. And there are movements and governments in Latin America that for a longer period of time have been committed to, we are going to build an alternative. We're going to build an alternative that's fairer, that's more environmentally sound, and that it's a new kind of 21st century socialism. There's a lot to learn from what they have already done and see how much better it works for ordinary people. And there's a lot of inspiration that we should draw from the fact that, well, it obviously is possible for people to organize and do that and win that, because look how much they have accomplished and look how much progress they have made. So whenever we get discouraged and think to ourselves, oh, but are we ever going to win? Can we ever sort of accomplish anything, that's beyond just sort of a rear guard action to mitigate damage from the latest disaster? Can we really move forward? We need to look at Latin America for some inspiration and example that, yes, you can move forward. And we need to do that, too. We need to be doing a lot of the things that they have been doing for better and longer than we have.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Your book, Of the People, By the People, A Case for Participatory Economy, is now available. Tell us, how can people access your book?
I mean, you want to support local bookstores, progressive bookstores. So you want to try and buy it through them. If they don't have it, tell them to get it in stock. If that's not the way you can do it, you can get it through any of the online places. AK Press is the distributor, and if you buy it through AK Press, that also helps, a left independent publishing outlet, stay in business. So that's better than buying it on Amazon, but you can buy it on Amazon if you have no alternative.
Thank you again for being with us this morning.
Okay, it's great being with you, Sylvia.
Take care.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.